Thank you very much. Just got my notes sorted. Okay, so I've got 20, 30 minutes or so to do. I'm going to try to cram in like as much as I can really quickly, and then we're going to have some time for Q&A at the end. 10 minutes, 15 minutes, we'll see how it goes.
We'll just run with it.
Okay. So hopefully I can stimulate some thinking and get some questions from the audience. I think Ed agreed he would ask one for sure on my behalf, just to make me feel good. Okay. So I'm gonna talk about treaties, this concept of we're all treaty people. We heard this morning a land acknowledgement that we're on Treaty One territory. I'm going to talk about the history of the relationship between First Nations and all other Canadians, kind of what got us to where we are today, and I want to bridge that into a discussion about contemporary issues, things like Kapyong Barracks just down the road here, Northern Development, the company I work for now, work the Gateway Group. So if I miss things, when we get to Q&A, you have permission to kind of redirect me, because I may go off on tangent stories. Hopefully they're good stories, though. I'll try to squeeze that all into the time that we have. So the picture we have up here may be a bit hard to see, but it's a depiction of the negotiations that happened at Lower Fort Garry prior to the signing of Treaty One. So we've all heard this, you know, before the Jets games now, they do a treaty acknowledgement, before the Bombers games. Actually, the Winnipeg Blue Bombers were the first professional sports team in North America to do a land acknowledgement. You'll hear this acknowledgement, you hear it at gatherings all over the place. So what is it, and you know, why do we do that? And I'll talk first about why First Nations people sign treaties, and then why the Crown signed treaties. So, First Nations, 1871, August 3rd, 1871, you got a gathering of about between 2,000 and 3,000 First Nations people at Fort Garry, Lower Fort Garry, meeting with representatives of the Crown. So if you think back to that time, huge changes were happening. Buffalo populations that had sustained people for years were largely decimated. Population and power systems were changing. If you go back 100 years before that, First Nations held the bulk of power. You know, when Lord Selkirk came with the Scottish settlers through the Highland Clearances, Lord Selkirk came and the power dynamic was held largely by First Nations people. 1871, that was rapidly shifting. And First Nations saw these changes on the horizon. First Nations also had a long history of negotiating and codifying treaties amongst each other in North America. So the first European settlers who arrived in North America encountered a network of treaties between First Nations that had to do with trade, rights of passage through territory, access to territory, military alliances, neutrality agreements, all the, you know, agreements where one First Nation would agree to stay out of a conflict between other First Nations, all negotiated through protocols and ceremonies that First Nations had been using for hundreds and thousands of years in North America. So what you'll see depicted, where you see pipe ceremonies, if you get a chance to go to the exhibit in the Manitoba Museum right now that relates to treaty, you'll see a lot of pipes that were involved in the negotiations, protocols surrounding exchanging of gifts, ceremonies, sweat lodges, pipe ceremonies, shaking tents, all that went into the treaty-making process. So First Nations had a long history of signing treaties, negotiating treaties, codifying them through ceremony. Legally, this would be, if you want to look at historic kind of legal frameworks, this is First Nations coming to the treaty negotiations with a full backpack of legal traditions. So this is what we would refer to as Indigenous law, as opposed to Aboriginal law, which would be like case studies on Aboriginal cases. Indigenous law is what practices did we practice in negotiating treaty. Now the crown comes to the table with a very different perspective. August 3rd, 1871, Sir John A. Macdonald, the Prime Minister of Canada. As you know, Sir John A. Macdonald had this plan to unite the country from coast to coast, to build a railway across Canada. In order to get access to the land to implement this plan to unite Manitoba with then British Columbia, or with British Columbia, and build this railroad, the federal crown has to sign treaties with First Nations people. And this is based on precedent that goes way back to this document called the Royal Proclamation. How many of you have heard of the Royal Proclamation? 1763, that's awesome. Our education system is phenomenal. And kids in Manitoba are learning this stuff right now, so it's great. So the Royal Proclamation, 1763, a little bit of context. It's the end of the 7 years' war between the British and the French. King George III is the monarch, and the British come out of this conflict with huge, significant amounts of debt. So King George III has to do something to cut costs. What he does is unique in government in that he cut costs and raise taxes at the same time. Usually it's one or the other. The Royal Proclamation becomes this omnibus bill that King George III implements that has a huge impact on North America. So I don't know if there's a pointer on this. Yeah. So I'll step away from the mic here a bit, but the Royal Proclamation, what it does is it says the 13 British colonies, with the Appalachian Mountains separating the colonies from the rest of North America, we will reduce services west of the colonies, and we're going to start implementing taxation within the colonies themselves, which leads to the Boston Tea Party, huge implications on the as far as American history. And it cuts services west of the Appalachian Mountains. And it says in the proclamation that the land west of the colonies, this imaginary line, is First Nations land. It's Indigenous hunting territory. I can't remember the exact terminology, but it's the first Western legal recognition that Indigenous people held title to the land west of the 13 colonies in North America. And it also lays the groundwork for Western expansion beyond the colonies. So it says if you want to acquire land, here's the rules for acquiring land. One, it can only be the crown doing negotiations. It can't private individuals can't work amongst themselves to buy land. It has to be the crown. The negotiations have to be public. There has to be annuities attached to the land, and there has to be treaties signed in the negotiations. So this is the Royal Proclamation is this document that becomes foundational to relationships between First Nations and non-First Nations in North America, and it's still cited like in the Capion case. A lot of what's being discussed goes back to this document. And on the First Nations side, the Royal Proclamation is codified at the Treaty of Niagara a year later, and it's codified through this two-row wampum. It's a Iroquois Confederacy Symbolism doesn't give it justice. It's codified through indigenous tradition through the two-row wampum. So, based on this, Sir John A. Macdonald wants to settle or get access to Western Canada. He sends out treaty commissioners to start negotiating treaties. The negotiations started in Treaty 3, which is down here. But the treaty commissioners, the historic treaty commissioners, soon find that, hey, these First Nations we're dealing with are really tough negotiators. Negotiations start, the First Nations meet with the treaty commissioner of the time, and they say, hey, we know you want to acquire our land. We know you want to build a railroad. You've acknowledged it's our land. We have some unsettled business before we start negotiating this treaty. You've been running steamships up and down our waterways, cutting down wood to power these steamships. Here's a bill for all the wood you've taken off our land. And they forced the Crown to settle this before they even went into negotiations. So Treaty 3 was supposed to be Treaty 1. Treaty 1 gets negotiated, Treaty 2. These treaty commissioners go out, negotiate treaties across Western Canada. And as they're negotiating over time, of course, First Nations are communicating with each other and saying, you know, we negotiated for this. Treaty 1 is a 4-page document. By the time you get to Treaty 6, as an example, so they're saying, we negotiated for this. You start there. Ask for something else on top of that when the negotiations start. So Treaty 6, the Medicine Chest Clause is introduced to treaty, which goes way back to practice between the Hudson Bay Company and First Nations, where a medicine chest was exchanged. Treaty 8, no conscription and taxation is introduced to the text of the treaty. But these are called historic treaties. Over 70 historic treaties get negotiated between First Nations and the Crown. So if you look at this map, you're probably thinking, well, what about Quebec? What about British Columbia? What about Northern Canada? The Crown, even today, where there's no historic treaties, has a legal obligation to negotiate what are called either modern-day treaties or comprehensive land claim settlements. So even today as we speak, maybe not today, it's Saturday, but even yesterday, there was negotiations happening related to modern-day treaties in British Columbia. The James Bay Agreement in Quebec would be considered a modern-day treaty. The territory or the Nunavut Settlement Agreement would be considered a modern-day treaty. So you had two groups coming together, the relationship of enduring mutual obligation codified through this agreement called a treaty. And I would argue for both sides, these agreements had a lot to do with livelihood. It was where I'm from, so I'm from a Apaskwet Cree Nation in northern Manitoba. Treaty 5, hunting, trapping, and fishing gets included in the text. In 1875, hunting, trapping, fishing was livelihood. That was our access to kind of mainstream economies. So you'll hear a lot of First Nations elders talk about livelihood, livelihood, livelihood. And this concept of livelihood, what it meant in 1871, 1875, 1912, versus what it means in 2019 and 2020. So that's worth pondering because it's a huge issue that I don't think we've quite faced as a country yet. Some communities just really jumped in both feet into the changes they saw happening in the economy. In Western Manitoba, there's a number of First Nations that got really aggressive in farming, fisheries, different industries like that. So now, if I've painted this very rosy picture of the treaties being these wonderful, positive documents and agreements, But if we look at what's happening today in Canada, in Manitoba, let's say graduation rates on reserve around 36%, suicide rates in some communities 10 times the national average. All the negative indicators are high, all the positive indicators for well-being are low. There's something that went awry from when the treaties were negotiated to today. And who wants to have a guess at what that was? The Indian Act. Yep. I love having teachers in the audience. It's always So the Indian Act. So concurrent to the negotiations happening between First Nations and the Crown, the government is working on a piece of legislation to administer relations with First Nations communities. The Indian Act is introduced. The Indian Act is introduced based on, and if you're in government, and it's easy to look, it's easy to look back on this stuff and say, how could like people be so stupid, kind of, to do stuff like this? Of course, government has to legislate its bureaucracy to work on its behalf, or it won't work on its behalf. And the Indian Act is introduced with the philosophy that civilization and Christianity are one and the same, and that First Nations communities have to be pulled out of, I guess savagery would be the term of the day, hunter-gatherer societies, into civilization. And it's actually viewed as a hierarchical progress through stages. If any of you studied anthropology 20, 30, 40 years ago, you would have learned those stages that folks used to think that societies went through. And Christianity and civilization were viewed as the pinnacle and the top of this. So the Indian Act introduces policies to move First Nations out of hunter-gatherer societies to become Christianized and civilized. And it highly manages the lives of First Nations people in Canada. So it introduces, the Indian Act introduces Indian agents. Indian agents control basically everything that happens on reserve, socially, economically, all of it. So through the Indian Act, the government introduces the pass system. So if you want to leave the reserve, you first have to go find an Indian agent and then get a pass. This is a copy of the pass. So if I wanted to leave it, you know, and then if I was off reserve, I would have to have this pass. Jamie Wilson's authorized to leave the reserve for 3 weeks. He's allowed to carry a firearm or not. Here's what he's doing. If I was off reserve, I would have to give this or show this pass if it was requested. Through the Indian Act, the government introduces the residential school system, which we all know the impact that's had on Canadians, again, with the intent to civilize, quote unquote, and Christianize First Nations people. Through the Indian Act, the government takes the vote away from First Nations people. There was a brief period of time in the 1870s when First Nations could vote in Canada. That's taken away, and it doesn't come back until the 1960. Through the Indian Act, the government makes it illegal to represent a First Nations client without first getting the minister's approval to represent your client against the minister. Like, you have to get the Crown's approval to take the Crown to court against the Crown, like it's a, or you'll be disbarred. And this is one of the most absurd ones that this woman named Sarah Carter did her doctorate at the University of Manitoba, wrote about a great book called Lost Harvest. The government introduces what's called the peasant farmer policy. So again, with the thinking, we've got to get First Nations from hunter-gatherer to civilization, and there's steps. Europe learned tremendously from small farms and manual labor. So the policy said that First Nations people were not allowed to use labor-saving farming machinery in their farming practices. Made it illegal overnight First Nations could only farm with hand tools. A burgeoning industry becomes absolutely decimated overnight. So all these policies of policies of dependence, I guess, get implemented over years and years and years, at a time when Canadians, more and more Canadians, were gaining more and more rights, non-property holders getting the right to vote, women getting the right to vote. Individual Canadians are getting more and more rights. First Nations rights are rapidly being eroded. And there was a pivotal time in our history when that started to get challenged. And that goes back to veterans that came back from both World War I and World War II. Veterans who had volunteered at higher rates than any other group in Canada to serve. And the way my dad describes this, because he asked a lot of the, in my community, we had a number of veterans that served in World War I, World War II in Korea. And when he was a young man, he asked them, why did you guys all sign up? Like, it seems like a huge amount of people signed up. And they said, it's treaty. We're part of a treaty relationship. When our treaty partner goes to war, we go to war. And when these folks enlisted, they went into a system, and I don't want to say there was no racism in the military, because there was and is racism in every institution in Canada, but they were put into a system where they were given rights. It was somewhat of a meritocracy. Some of them served and distinguished themselves. Tommy Prince would be a really good example. Canada's highest decorated soldier of all time. Sorry, most decorated soldier of all time. Not highest, most. And not Canada's most decorated Indigenous soldier, Canada's most decorated soldier of all time. He received more medals for bravery than any soldier in Canadian history. He comes back from serving, and all of a sudden he's back into a system that doesn't recognize him as a Canadian citizen, basically. So there's stories of Tommy Prince getting dragged out of the Legion in Selkirk, ripping the door off the hinges. The RCMP were called in because he wasn't allowed in the Legion. So these veterans come back. They start political organizations, and they start this political movement to go back to the treaties, recognize the treaties, understand the treaties, and implement that in the relationship. So the precursor to the Assembly of First Nations is started by veterans. The precursor to the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs is a movement started by veterans. And this has a huge impact. Okay. I have to be cognizant of time here. Okay. I'll leave that slide up because now I have to bridge us to this. Okay, so livelihood. The way that and you're hearing, when you're talking about treaties, you've got such a wide array of perspectives on what the modern interpretation of treaties means. Even within the federal government itself, Department of Justice within the federal government has a very, very strict interpretation of what treaties mean. I'll call that one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, you've got First Nations elders who, some of whom will say, hey, you guys haven't lived up to this. The land needs to go back to us. Like, you've got really, really diverse spectrums of interpretation of what it means. There's a few areas of agreement. That'd be that between everybody, that everybody in Canada needs to learn more about treaties. Everyone agrees with that. They're a fundamental part of our country and what makes us, kind of constitutes us as a country. And this concept of livelihood, there's a growing consensus that these are economic agreements that have to do with livelihood. So when we're talking about implementing treaties in a modern context, we have to talk about livelihood. Kapyong, as an example, 160 acres of land, that Treaty 1 First Nations, actually there's a whole bunch of First Nations that were part of Treaty, were supposed to get allotments of land that didn't receive it for whatever reason. Sometimes mistakes were made, sometimes it was just overt theft. These communities are old land, their agreements are made where they said, okay, you get first dibs on Crown land. Now First Nations are saying, we want to use those opportunities. We want to use duty to consult. We want to use treaty land entitlement for economic leverage. So we want to employ our community members. We want equity stakes in business partnerships. We want a seat at the table, basically. Quick bridge, I guess, into my company, Arctic Gateway Group. We are formed through a partnership between Northern Manitoba First Nations and Bayline Communities, which own 50% of our company, and Fairfax Financial Holdings out of Toronto, which owns the other 50%. Northern Workforce, just this summer we moved our workforce from 48 or so folks to 183. And as we get more and more grain shipping out of the Port of Churchill, I think our workforce numbers will just keep going up and up. And we're trying to hire Northerners. We've actually found the people from outside the North that we hired had a 70% attrition rate. So we're realizing, okay, we got to hire people from the North to stay in the North. So I guess crammed in a lot. So now we've got a few minutes for question and answer. There, now I can go to my last slide there. Yep. Thank you. Really interesting question. You guys all heard that? Pretty much, yeah. So Kevin Chief's a really good friend of mine. Kevin and I talk about this all the time because Kevin does a lot of speaking engagements. And it's easy to go and talk to a receptive audience that you know kind of might agree with you before you even start. To me, I've learned the most from elders like Harry Bone, who works with the Treaty Commission, Justice Sinclair from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. From my experience, the way that Kevin does his presentations, we try not to do a lot of blaming and shaming. Because the minute you start, like if I came in here and said, white people are all racist. Like first thing you're gonna do, and my mom's white, so I can maybe, no, I can't say that. That's right away I'm judging all of you and I'm blaming people and shaming people. You get your backs up and you're not gonna hear a word that I said, right? Justice Sinclair says, if you wanna get somebody from their position to your position, you walk to them, you take their hand, and you walk them to you. If you stand here and you yell at them, there's no way they're gonna even meet you partway, right? So I think if the message is you can never be objective, but if at least you try to give some context of what people were thinking at the day, because it's easy to look at this stuff and say, everybody was evil who made those decisions, but it denies, if you do stuff like that, I think it it stops you, like, it's too easy to make those same decisions again, because none of us are evil. We would never make evil decisions. So, you know, from your work, like, you gotta, I don't know, I'm having a hard time explaining this. So, does that sort of kind of even answer your question?
Yeah, I really like that comment
about walking back instead of walking back. Yeah, and it's rewarding. Like, I've presented to audiences that were, I've been sworn at in meetings. I remember one meeting we did in, I shouldn't name the community, but I will. It was in Lac Da Bonnie, and there was rumors about Brokenhead taking over a huge chunk of land that was cabin owner's land. And there's all these rumors circulating about people's homes are going to be repossessed, and they're going to build a casino, of course, you know, right there on the waterfront, and everyone's going to have to move out of their cabins, homes that people love. There was just open hostility. But we found that by just calmly working through these issues, that we went a long way to resolving a lot of the angst that was in the community. And sometimes you have to have empathy for people on the other side too, right? Which is really, really, it can be really, really difficult. But if you base it on empathy for the other person's perspective, even if you 110% disagree with it, I think it helps to move them towards your position. Maybe that's manipulative, I don't know. Yeah, another really good question, especially with the Métis throwing the wrench in the Kapyong deal. So the Métis, and I've had this debate with David Chartrand back when I was treaty commissioner, because I said, David, we're all treaty people. And David Chartrand said, no way, buddy. I'm Métis, I'm not treaty. And we kind of went back and forth. And then, so the Manitoba Act is the... I would argue would be the treaty that recognizes the Métis as a nation established here in Manitoba. And there was provisions within the Manitoba Act that gave certain amounts of land to Métis people. I'm not as well versed on the Métis arguments, but from my perspective, the Métis, in the Métis arguing that the Manitoba Act is their treaty, it gives them a foundational document to say to the government, we had this agreement, we need to move towards recognizing this agreement, you need to treat us the same way as you would Indians under the Indian Act. The term Indian is a legal definition. And then if the Métis are defined as Indians under the Indian Act, that carries certain rights. So there's a point I forgot to mention here, which kind of highlights this. So for all, as bad as the Indian Act is, what the Indian Act does is those rights that were negotiated, so Treaty 5, hunting, trapping, fishing, Treaty 6, Medicine Chest, Treaty 8, taxation. The Indian Act says everyone that's an Indian under the Indian Act, it codifies, and anyone that's a status Indian in Canada carries those rights. So now the Métis are arguing that they're part of that definition as well, which forces the federal government to treat them, bring honor to the relationship. So I don't know if that answers your question again, but these are all very tough questions. We'll go here and then there and then over here and then here.
I was just wondering, yeah. In the modern age, we used to live in Thunder Bay.
Yeah.
They've been dumping poison in the river and about 20 miles down with an Indian band there, and they've been in the paper many times. And I think even that Japanese government had written Canadian about this situation west of Dryden. And they just keep poisoning the water, and it goes right, and they're taking their water out of there. And you think after 60 years, somebody could figure out how they could avoid that situation, but they're still doing it. But you've never been to Dryden and see that crap coming out of the thing there.
And I think there's a lot of chiefs that would argue that same, that instance may not be happening like the exact same thing, but the thinking behind it is still happening in a lot of relationships. I think there's a lot of chiefs that would still argue that the power balance isn't there. And if you've got a population that, first of all, wasn't allowed to vote, they're not going to have the same voice in parliament or in the legislature as other people. So you've got a number of First Nations leaders now that are saying, okay, you're a mill. The example would be Canadian Craft Paper and the Paw. When Tolko left, negotiations happened with a bunch of companies that wanted to take over the mill. The deal was almost done, 2 minutes, and Swampy Cree Tribal Council came in and said, whoa, what are you guys doing? Like, you haven't talked to us yet. We want 50% of the forest management license, or this deal's dead. And forced the province's hand, forced the Canadian Craft Paper's hand, and they became partners in the FML, one of its kind, really. So, over here.
Might take longer than 2 questions, better than 2 minutes. But okay. What sorts of things can be done or need to be done in order to strengthen Indigenous self-determination under the Indian Act?
I think supporting. I'll use my chief as an example, Christian Sinclair. He's used historic rights and obligations like the duty to consult as an economic lever. So OCN will say anything that happens in our traditional territory, we want to be part owners of it. And part owners means we want jobs. And we want to be part of your supply chain. And we want preferential bidding on contracts. And we want this and this and this. So there's more and more leaders that are leveraging those constitutional tools economically and creating employment in their communities through that, I guess. So, yeah. So real quick, yeah, over here.
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks also to the Jubilee Fund for this event. It's been tremendous. Two quick questions. First is kind of following on this gentleman's question around earlier this week, Carol Ann Hilton was here.
Yep.
She talked about this concept called indigenomics, and she mentioned specifically this idea of changing the narrative around how Indigenous people are a burden to society, to one of recognizing that Indigenous people and Indigenous economy is one that really is a benefit and is actually an opportunity for this country to be embracing. So just your thought about what this whole Indigenous economy opportunity means for local, regional, and national economy. And secondly, more personally, how does a kid from Opaskwayak First Nation, what are some of the things that you can share personally that allowed you as a young man, an Indigenous man, to take the path that you did to be so successful and so inspiring in the work that you did?
Okay, I'll try to squeeze that in 1 minute. Indigenomics, I love the work she's doing. And in fact, I have to figure out a way to include this in my presentation. The Rural Development Institute did a study last year. If you get a chance to look it up, it's called the Indigenous Contribution to the Manitoba Economy. It's the first time it's been done in Western Canada, where they looked at First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities in Manitoba and the population and what impact that has on our GDP. So we know it's a $2.3 billion impact on our GDP. It employs 35,000 people in the province of Manitoba. I'm trying to remember the numbers off the top of my head. FNMI spend close to $9.3 billion in the province. Huge tax base, close to $300 million of taxes get paid by those communities in the province. As an impact, it's just below agriculture. And you know how big ag is in Manitoba? As far as its impact on our GDP. Now, if you want to grow, and this is where I think there's huge opportunity for Manitoba. So if you look at economic development research that's been done internationally, politically everybody focuses on business relocation. Winnipeg got Ubisoft. Wow, everyone loves that. You know, Portage got Roquette. Everybody loves that stuff. But that has a very, very small impact on economic development of a region, maybe 2-3%. SME growth has a very big impact. The biggest impact, if you want to affect the economy of a region, is pulling in disadvantaged and disengaged populations into your economy. If you want to have a huge impact, that's where it is. So, and we know that in Manitoba, we've got unemployment rates as high as 70% on some communities. If you want to impact our GDP hugely, that's where the focus needs to be. If you can get those disadvantaged, disengaged folks into the economy, it makes the Roquette deal look like peanuts, like it's, that's maybe peas, makes it look like peas. Where did, on my journey, I would attribute it to my grandmother, my dad's mom. My dad grew up on the trap line, and we kind of share the story that he shared with us. When he was a kid, he was sitting with my moosum one day on the trap line. They were trapping muskrats, and he was sitting on a muskrat hut, and he says he remembers looking at the horizon, and it was one of those days where it was in the winter. You can't tell where the horizon stops and the snow begins. Like it was just one. And he said to my grandpa, or my musum, that I want to find out what's beyond the horizon. Because my musum always wanted him to take over the trap line, right? My musum was very, very hurt. Didn't talk to him for like months after that. But my dad went on with the encouragement of my grandmother to, went to high school in Prince Albert. He got his bachelor's degree from University of Saskatchewan. One of the first cohorts of Indigenous students there. Him and Ovid Mercury kind of were pals back in the day. They were kind of pushing the envelope. Then him and my mom both got their master's and doctorates from UCSB in Santa Barbara in confluent education. You guys remember confluent education? Really at the time, cutting edge. Radical thinking that students had feelings. Imagine, like, they always pushed in us, and OCN is pretty unique in this regard. I think we've got now, I'd say probably 30 plus PhDs out of our community, but only one plumber. So if you want to start a plumbing business, yeah. But our community's been very, very aggressive on pushing education and the importance of education. And my parents would say, Elder Harry Bone says the same thing. The reserve is like our home base. Go out and conquer the world, but come back to the reserve. Like that's your home, where your home is. So yeah. And as our chief says now, because we have band members all over the world, the sun never sets on Opaskwak Cree Nation. Okay, thank you very much.